stayed for 2 weeks teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock, and it was the first usual lengthy retreat that I've taught there. All the teachers taught the one-week retreat in July, but having all the teachers there made it a little bit different spirit than the usual retreats, at least for the spirit, at least for the teachers. And this was a retreat for old students, meaning people who've done a fair amount of practice. And it was 2 weeks long, and it was a real pleasure. It was really, at times I couldn't believe that, you know, that I was, I thought maybe I'd been reborn in heavenly realms. The retreat center at Spirit Rock is quite beautiful, with a large meditation hall and a very quiet, serene environment, kind of up a valley, kind of quietly away from the main road. And this little village, Dharma Village, with these four residential buildings for where people stay in single and double rooms, and then this meditation hall and dining hall, and all these great nice people just doing nice things, no one being upset particularly, just all this great food being cooked. I got to have all the sleep I wanted, which with a, you know, those of you who don't know, with a baby at home, that's quite special. And it was wonderful. I got to meditate much more than I usually do every day, and it was really sweet. I felt it was really kind of divine in some ways. But I was quite inspired by the retreat, not so much by these wonderful kind of heavenly realm kind of qualities of the retreat, but rather by the engagement, the practice of the retreatants, those people who are practicing away there. And I was very deeply moved and impressed and inspired by their efforts, their intentions of being there, and by the experiences they had there of being on retreat for 2 weeks. So I wanted to talk tonight a little bit about retreats. They're an important part of our tradition, going off on retreats. And I would like to ask first, how many of you have been on a 10-day retreat? Great. So some of you know what's all about, and some of you don't. When I signed up for my first 7-day retreat many years ago, and then a week before the retreat was supposed to start, I called up the retreat center and said that something has come up and I can't come. And they said, oh, okay. And they canceled. They kind of deleted my name from the roster for the retreat. And what I didn't tell them, that what had come up was fear. So the first retreat that I ever signed up for, I chickened out of. What do you think of that? Your loyal and courageous teacher chickened out. Many cultures value the importance of stepping outside of our normal life, our normal social life, our normal everyday life, so we can discover aspects of our humanity that are often invisible when we're busy socializing or busy living our normal lives or busy working. And it's very important to have this opportunity to step outside, in a sense. If we take the world and we take ourselves and take our the life we're living for granted, then it's all too easy for us to just kind of go along and not reflect deeply about what the underlying values and underlying worldviews and opinions that support our life. It's all too easy to be carried along by the flow and the stream of popular culture rather than looking deeply and maybe stepping outside of that stream. So I think I just thought of a couple of simple examples. There's probably a better list, but for example, in Native American tradition, sometimes they would go on vision quests. People would go and actually leave their particular everyday life and go off into the mountains or the desert or the woods by themselves, live in solitude for some period of time, perhaps fast for 3 or 4 days or a week, and go on a vision quest, waiting for some vision or some revelation or something different to happen, some new insight or understanding. Other traditions talk about periods of time in the wilderness. 40 days is a classic one for the Western culture. But 40 days in the wilderness, going off again into periods of solitude, periods of time when one is not engaged in the normal pursuits of everyday life. And a lot of traditional cultures have actually institutionalized or have in their cultures rituals of separation, separating from the tribe from some period of time, sometimes called liminal phases in people's lives, where they actually go out and the normal status, the normal positions in society, the normal work that they do is stripped from them. And they go off and are sometimes literally left quite naked, but symbolically naked at least, from all the ways in which they usually identify themselves as being a person. And in not having the usual ideas of I'm the son of a chief, or I'm the daughter of, you know, someone else, you know, or I'm this kind of worker or that kind of worker, but rather go off and just be without any labels in a very radical and complete way, allows a person then to settle and look into their life in a much more clearer way than if they're always seeing their life through a label. Now, the great historian Toynbee claims that he studied the lives of many of the famous religious leaders, religious figures down through the ages, the founders of great religions like the Buddha and Jesus. And he claimed that one of the patterns in those lives is that they would have, there'd be cycles of what he called withdrawal and return. Withdrawal and return. That people would withdraw from their everyday life for a while, and then something would change for them during that period of withdrawal, and then they would return again into their life. In the Buddhist tradition, we say returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. So we withdraw for a while into retreat to discover the great gift, and then with that gift, we come back with open hands, offering that gift back into our society. So the equivalent for our tradition of this period of withdrawal is we just call retreats, kind of easy word. And it's kind of like living a pseudo-monastic life for a short period of time, mimicking a little bit what it'd be like if you became a Buddhist monk or a nun. It's a formal schedule of getting up early in the morning, periods of sitting meditation and walking meditation, hearing Dharma talks. It's mostly silent, except for the teachers who have interviews and talk with students and give the talks. And people are expected to follow the five precepts while they're on retreat. And that includes a precept of celibacy, being celibate for those 10 days or however long the retreat is. And I don't think it really occurs to too many people that they're going to be involved in sexual activity on retreat. So, or at least not they're going to act. They don't think they're going to act on it. It might occur, but the thought might occur. The idea of taking a vow of celibacy for 10 days is kind of like goes right by some people because that's not what not why they're there. But actually, it's in that sense, it's kind of a traditional monastic lifestyle for a period of time. And it's a time of great simplicity. It's radically simple. There's usually very little the person needs to do on retreat except show up when the bells ring and sit for a while, and then the bells ring and you get up and walk for a while, and the bell rings and you go sit for a while, and the bell rings and you sit for a while. You get up and walk for a while, the bell rings, and then maybe you go have lunch. And lunch is made for you, which is so all you have to do is show up. And then you have your lunch, and then there's usually a period of time afterwards where you have a little break. And there's no one to talk to because no one's supposed to be talking. So you don't have to go through the energy and exhaustion of socializing with the people. So you just kind of, you know, can quietly walk the land or kind of go take a little nap or just be really quiet, and it's very nice. And then the bell rings and you go and sit. And then after a while, you go and walk. And then you sit. And then you walk. And then it's time for tea. You know, so it goes. And then the evening, there's a Dharma talk. So it's very simple. There's usually one period of work meditation each day. We're going to be washing dishes or pots or maybe helping a little bit with a prep in the kitchen. So it's a period of time of simplicity and silence. Which supports the opportunity, the possibility for us to look deeply, very deeply, into our lives and to be able to settle into a kind of a non-reactivity. I think what happens to most of us when we live our lives, kind of normal lives, going to work and socializing and being with family or whatever we do, having to go shopping and cooking and pay our bills and take our car and get its oil changed and fit it all in between, you know, fit it all in kind of in our tight schedules for many of us. Many of us spend our lives not noticing how we're distracted from ourselves. We're always outwardly oriented, take care of things and doing things. And in that outward orientation, for many of us, we don't see the reactive quality of the mind. The mind likes this and doesn't like that. It prefers this over that. It judges, it criticizes, it grasps and wants it to be different. It pushes it away because it doesn't like it. It's a constant reactivity. And when the retreat life, where our life becomes really simple, and there's not many, you don't have to make many decisions, you know, because you don't have to choose what kind of food you're going to eat because it's just there when you show up. You don't have to decide where you're going to go because the bell tells you, now it's time to sit. And so in that kind of simplicity, the normal busyness of reactive of the mind tends to settle down quietly. And when we stop living in constant reactivity, then we tend to be able to see much more deeply into who we are and what reality is like. So we go on retreats periodically, and it's one of the great ways of deepening a mindfulness practice for those people who have a daily practice. To go periodically, once or twice a year, in retreat is phenomenally powerful and useful. In the ancient scriptures of the Buddha, Buddhist scriptures, they said that the Buddha, after he was enlightened, continued to go on retreats himself. He would periodically go off into the woods, and sometimes as long as for a month at a time or 2 weeks at a time, and do his own self-retreat, his own private retreat, as a way of, I don't know why the Buddha went on a retreat exactly, but sometimes it's said for his pleasure. It was a very pleasant thing to be able to do. It's very pleasant to be on retreat. It can be very pleasant. Actually, it's not always pleasant. Sometimes, you know, maybe teachers forget. It looks like the teachers might forget what it's like. So I wanted to mention a little bit some of the benefits of going on retreat. One of the ones which seems to interest many people who live stressed out lives is that retreats are a time to de-stress. They're a wonderful place to relax. Because of this thing I said, there's very little need to react against or decide about on retreat. And so the mind has, and the body has a chance to finally rest and not to kind of add more stress and more reactivity on top of what's already there. And you can see layers and layers of stress just fall off people as they sit on retreat. And it's quite remarkable that in a longer retreat, you find that some people will actually end up sleeping quite little. It's not so unusual to have people sleeping maybe 4 or 5 hours a night. And they're getting all the rest that they need. Because many of us, the amount of sleep we need is related to how much stress we take on during the day. And stress is all has to do with how we react, our reactivity to the environment. And when we don't react so much, then a tremendous amount of energy is preserved and we don't need to, perhaps, to sleep as much. And people get even less sleep. I mean, there are people who get 2 hours of sleep, or I've known people who have gone 3 days without any sleep at all on retreat, and they didn't seem to be any less, any worse for the wear. When I was sitting for 3 months at Barry, I managed on about 4.5 hours of sleep for about 2.5 months every night. So it de-stresses, it relaxes, and some people come to retreat just, you know, for that purpose. The second thing, the benefit of retreats, is its revealing qualities. The practice of a retreat tends to reveal deep aspects of our life. And one of the things, for example, that we tend to learn from doing mindfulness practice is how much we look outside of ourselves for happiness, fulfillment, safety, for perfection, for security, for control. We are often oriented outside, wanting this and wanting that experience, wanting that particular material good, wanting that kind of relationship, wanting that kind of work, wanting that kind of house, wanting that kind of recreational opportunity. And it's possible to kind of be spinning around, always looking outside. And the movement outwards doesn't really allow us to enter into or to find the deepest levels of peace that are available within us. We have to turn inward. We have to turn our awareness away from all the objects of the world, all its various forms, and turn the awareness inwards into ourselves to understand ourselves in a new way. And the simplicity of retreats, the mindfulness practice of a retreat, allows this undistracted ability to turn the mirror of awareness back into ourselves and see what's going on within us. Instead of pursuing desires, we use the mindfulness to understand the impulse for desire. Instead of acting on hate and aversion, we turn the awareness back to understand the roots for aversion and hate. Meditation, mindfulness meditation, has a lot to do with stopping and turning the awareness back into ourselves. To stop looking in the wrong directions for our happiness. So, one of the things that that people often discover on retreat is how much they're looking outside of themselves for answers. And on retreat, outside answers don't come very easily. You can't go out and get an ice cream very easily on a retreat. You can't turn on the television. You can't. There's a lot of things you normally can't do. And so the mind somehow, because it can't get easily what it wants, the habitual reactive impulses sometimes stand out much more starkly than they usually do. And in standing out more starkly, there's a chance of understanding the roots of them and going below them, letting go of them, discovering a deeper level of peace. But it takes a while. And one of the things that's discovered or revealed on a retreat is a tremendous amount of momentum that our normal life sets into motion. There's momentum in physical tension. And the first many days for some people on a retreat has a lot to do with dealing with the physical tension in the body. The shoulders are tight and hurt tremendously. Or the stomach is all in knots, or different places in the body hold tension. One of the interesting things that happens on retreats is the first couple of days, some people will find that the surface muscles of their body relax, and, oh, this is really great, I can do this forever. And then when the surface muscles relax, some of the deeper holding patterns, the deeper tension that's usually not sensed or felt because it's covered by those surface muscles, those deeper tensions show themselves. And they're much more painful sometimes, much more tight than the surface tension. And then people have to deal with some days of being present for this very strong tension deep inside as it begins to unravel, unknot, and release itself. So you see this momentum of reactivity, momentum of the mind. I mean, many of you probably saw that just today sitting here. I saw it in myself. I've been doing many different things this afternoon, and I sat down here, and my mind was still doing them. You know, and I was shopping at the supermarket, and before when I first sat down here, I was still in the supermarket. And you know, I brought part of my day with me, and kind of the momentum of that reactivity and concerns and everything kind of stayed with me. And so, as the mind gets more subtle and quieter on meditation retreat, it isn't just simply, you know, you forget about going shopping. Those kind of subtle, kind of mundane things don't last very long. But the deeper momentums of our life, the deeper reactions, concerns, the deeper underlying concerns that support much of our preoccupations begin showing themselves much more clearly as we quiet down. One of the very interesting things we see on retreat is the subtle ways in which we use meditation as means of escaping from ourselves. Of course, meditation, the very purpose of meditation is not to escape from oneself, but rather to discover and see oneself very deeply. But often there's very subtle intentions that come into play when people meditate every day that aren't so obvious, but don't become obvious until a person goes on retreat. So, for example, a person might be really attached to getting calm, and they think that's what meditation is all about. And so they come and they sit every day at home, And the normal surface tension of their life kind of relaxes, and they feel kind of calmer after doing 30 minutes or 40 minutes of meditation. It's really great. Oh, this meditation is great. It's really calming. Everybody should do it. And we go out and tell our friends that you should all meditate because it makes you calm. And then we go on retreat. And that initial kind of easy level of calm that we discover, just, you know, in 40 minutes of sitting, happens very quickly, maybe in the first day of the retreat. And then we don't get any calmer. And rather than getting calmer, the calmness we discover reveals a whole deeper level of anxiety or fear or frustration or that we're usually not in touch with. And so then the person will kind of continually be looking for the calm, trying to make the calm happen, because that's really what they think meditation's about. And that's what they've been trying, that's what they've been doing in meditation for the last year at home, is making themselves calm. But when you can't do that anymore in the deeper, more subtle levels of meditation, then that attachment to calm, that desire for calm, reveals itself much more starkly than it would in everyday practice. And you see it in the face, and you realize, wait a minute, and it's really painful. You see how painful it is to be attached to calm and really desiring it and wanting it and trying to make it happen and plan and strategize for it. And so a person realizes, maybe perhaps, that, oh, maybe that's not the point of meditation. Maybe I don't need to be pursuing calm all the time. And they let go of it, and they might discover a much deeper purpose of meditation that's not based on any kind of experience you can have. In a subtle kind of way, searching for calm, searching for happiness, or searching for bliss is often a way of actually searching for something outside of ourselves. Not literally outside of ourselves, but outside of the deep level of peace, the deep level of intimacy we can have with ourselves when we're not looking for particular experiences to solve our life for us. Another benefit of retreats, perhaps the one that most people think is the purpose of retreats, is to deepen concentration, to deepen mindfulness, and to deepen our loving kindness, our compassion. And certainly having the opportunity in an undistracted way to develop the mindfulness practice all day long without having to do all kinds of busy things is phenomenally useful in strengthening and deepening the mindfulness and the concentration. It's just such a lovely thing to be able to do. I think it's just such, it makes me happy to think about to spend a whole day without any interruptions trying to be awake, trying to be present, trying to enjoy what it's like to be in the present moment. How many of you, if you study your day, what happens in your mind as a course of a day, what percentage of the time are you ahead of yourself into the future? And what percent of the time are you behind yourself in what's happened earlier in the day or yesterday or 10 years ago? And what percentage of your time are you in neither, but simply in fantasy? And how much time is left over where you're actually present right now and right here for what's happening as things unfold? So the opportunity of a retreat is to try to change those percentages so there's a much greater majority of the time we're actually present in the present moment to discover the wonderful joy of life in the present moment. To be alive is to be in the present moment. To discover our aliveness, the joy of being alive, you have to be in the present moment. You can't be in the future or the past. Another benefit of retreats is with the deepening of concentration and mindfulness is to discover deeper spiritual potentials that we all have. Buddhism is phenomenally optimistic about human nature. Tendency in Buddhism is to feel that the fundamental core of human beings is beautiful, is luminous, is sometimes it's called the Buddha nature. And that when we allow ourselves a chance to let the reactivity settle, our preoccupations and distractedness settle away, that when all those settle, what gets shining up through the middle of it, what's left is this core of beauty, this core of Buddha nature, the sacred core. Sometimes this process of discovering a deeper potential of peace is described to be like a forest, a pond, a muddy pond, that if you keep stirring up the mud never settles. But if you allow the mud to be undisturbed, if you don't go stirring up it anymore, the pond stirring it anymore, then the pond will slowly settle, all the mud will go to the bottom, and the pond will become clear, and you see everything really clearly. And it said the mind is the same way, that if we stop reacting all the time to experiences into life and let things be, then the sediment of the mind begins to settle to the bottom, and the mind becomes crystal clear, and you can see right through it, just like a clear pond. So discover that level of clarity and peace, that is our potential, is in some sense our birthright, is one of the opportunities that exists of being on retreat. Another possibility is this experience of non-reactivity, or to explain non-reactivity in another way, it's being ourselves completely, allowing ourselves to be ourselves completely. In Zen they say, not adding a second head on top of our head, just allowing ourselves to be who we are. And then allowing ourselves to be who we are, to really understand and accept ourselves for all our sufferings, all our joys, and all our limitations. To allow ourselves to be who we are, not to be judging ourselves negatively, which is also common in our culture. And in doing that, beginning to see alternative ways of seeing ourselves. It's epidemic in our culture, the amount of people who feel shame and guilt and inadequacy and lack of self-worth. And that's a particular way of seeing ourselves that belongs to the reactive world. And when the reactive world begins to settle down, begins to have cracks in it, and you see through it, we begin to see that an alternative way of seeing ourselves. And we can see ourselves through our beauty rather than through our judgments. The simplicity of retreats is quite remarkable, because as people sit in retreats, they realize that how little is needed to be happy. Nothing's happening. There's no television or movies or entertainment except for the Dharma talk. you're sitting and walking and having good food, and you realize, you don't need so much to be really happy. It's some of my happiest times in my life have been on a retreat. And, basically I had nothing. And I think it's kind of a radical message in a consumerist culture. The idea that you can have phenomenal happiness without owning anything. It's kind of a perverted idea. if that idea got out too popularly, they'd probably jail us, because, it would subvert the whole economy. Imagine if our economy was based on people realizing that they don't need anything to be happy. That would be... And as people begin to see there's alternative ways of being on retreat, they tend to relax their ego-centered ways of living. The ego-centered drive for ambition or for things or for status, or the ego-centered ways in which we're afraid or shy. And these are replaced with trust in ourselves, trust in life itself. And egotism, with all its various forms of conceit and condemnations of others, and is replaced by acceptance and tolerance. I call the retreat kind of pseudo-monastic life. It's interesting, the lives of monks and nuns, because sometimes in many monasteries where they're not on retreat but actually working and taking care of the monastery, they can do many of the same activities that we do in normal life. And if you go, like, for example, to the San Francisco Zen Center, which you find people there who, the president of the organization, accountants and treasurers and bakers and cooks and people into publishing and desktop design and all kinds of, things that are just not so different than what people do anywhere else. And like people everywhere, they do various they do their jobs in various levels of proficiency. Sometimes with less proficiency than sometimes outside, because one of the things at a monastery is you don't necessarily get assigned to a particular job because you're skilled in it, which is usual way in society. So I've known people who were assigned to be head cook who didn't know anything about cooking. Or I was almost made head of the Zen Center's Alaya Stitchery, which is their stitchery where they made robes and clothes and zafus. And I didn't know anything about sewing, but I was going to be made head of it. But that didn't happen. But what's interesting about this is that monks and nuns aren't so concerned, at least maybe about the success and failure of their particular jobs, as people tend to be out in society. Because a monastic person, their identity, their vocation, what they're really about is not about being a good accountant or being a good seamster or tailor or being a good whatever they're doing, cook. What their job is about is discovering the truth. What their job is about for a monastic is discovering the spiritual peace that's possible to be found in all of us. And this engagement, this intention of spiritual life is much more important for them than the success and failure of their particular job. And so they might fail miserably at some of their jobs, and it doesn't have such a big impact on themselves in the way that many of us in our society would feel really terrible about ourselves if we failed in our jobs. Failure is allowed in the monastery. Failure is not so much allowed in our society here. We don't allow ourselves all kinds of failures. And so the example, I think, of a monastic person for us is that maybe there's other ways of seeing ourselves. There's other places we can rest our lives and our well-being than on the usual areas of success and failure, which again is looking outside of ourselves for our peace and our well-being. We do our best always, but in doing our best, can we still be at peace with ourselves when we even fail in our whatever we're doing? My early retreats were not easy for me. I eventually did sign up for some, obviously. And I remember them being very, very difficult, very painful, both physically and emotionally. And one of the remarkable things about my early years of practice and early retreats was that what was being cultivated inside of me during those times was a tremendous compassion for myself. And then compassion for the people around me, because I saw my own suffering so deeply. And I had no idea that what I was doing was cultivating compassion. I thought what I was doing was cultivating wisdom and getting enlightened. And rather, what was happening, I was getting compassioned. And most people, we don't have a word, I don't think we have a word in English, being compassioned. You know, people want to get, you know, enlightenment or bust is the great saying, you know. I'm going to get enlightened. But I think it's more important to get compassioned. And no one goes and retreats. People show up on retreats and say, I'm here to get enlightened. Well, great. No one shows up and says, I'm here to get compassioned. And that's what happened to me in my early years of practice. In bringing mindfulness and honesty and stopping and looking at myself deeply and seeing the tremendous suffering I had, what was born was tremendous compassion. And this leads to this point that I think the best in people comes out of them when they're on retreat. Or I say it this way, I think the very best in people tends to come out of them slowly, sometimes, when they do a mindfulness practice. And when you do a mindfulness practice all day long, like on retreat, it's very hard for bitterness and anger and resentment and greed and lust to survive very well. Because usually those things, in order to be preoccupied with those things, we can't be present. We're not really present if we're preoccupied and burning with resentment and greed. And since the practice of mindfulness is to be present, part of the process of coming present is coming to terms with these things, to let go of the clinging and the holding that empowers resentment and greed in all the forms, anger and form. So what you see on retreat, you see all this best of people coming out. And it's quite phenomenal. Sometimes people will come to interview at the beginning of the retreat and complain about someone else on the retreat. My roommate snores. Or, you can't believe how disrespectful my roommate is. She just comes into my room and turns on the light when I'm sleeping and makes all this noise. That's pretty common, people say that. And then there's the person you share your work with. This person, the person's a complete klutz. The person and there's a whole litany of things they might say about their work person that just not working. And just terrible, and how could it be so disrespectful? And the other classic one is someone who's sitting nearby in the meditation hall. There's someone nearby who's breathing so heavily. Or I don't believe it. I mean, it just has garlic coming out, and just everywhere is garlic. Or they're always, farting or burping or scratching themselves or coming in late or this, it's like. And so people are often at the beginning of the retreat, or maybe in the middle of the retreat, start complaining. And teachers will say, some wise advice. Whatever good that is. And then by the end of the retreat, usually, people will come and say, I came to terms with that difficult person. And somehow they came to terms with them. And it's in many different ways. Sometimes out of an act of compassion, they see the other person much more deeply. Or perhaps the person who's snorting in the meditation hall next to you. You no longer see the person as outside of yourself. There's no inside and outside. It just sounds. It's a snort just passing through like the sound of a bird. And there's no resistance to it. And when there's no resistance, you can be quite at peace. And it might be that for some people, the deeper significance of a retreat, a mindfulness retreat, is not the calm or the peace they discover during the retreat, but rather discover a capacity of letting go of resentment or greed or lust or whatever, and find themselves with some level of acceptance about something very difficult on the retreat that normal life they never would have accepted. Because normal life, you either run away or you deal with it in some matter-of-fact way. You talk to them. And on retreat, you have to deal with it through your own mindfulness. And it's powerful. It's for some people, I believe, in the long term, what was most useful about the retreat experience was not necessarily, as I said, the calm or the peace of that particular retreat, but rather learning the capacity of coming to terms with perhaps some difficulty, a difficult person in the retreat, some difficult issue inside of oneself, and discovering some peace inside. All right, so much I want to say about retreats. I'm so excited about retreats, coming back from 2 weeks on retreat. They're just really great. I just think one of the best things going. I'll end with one last thing. And that is that initially retreats can be quite difficult. And then at some point, people sometimes will have kind of peak experience in retreats. And wonderful things happen to them. But I think one of the most profound expressions of mindfulness practice, of engagement, involvement with mindfulness practice, is when a person is not pursuing any lofty ideal in the practice, but rather have taken on the mindfulness practice as their path for their life. And in a very simple, matter-of-fact, unremarkable way, the person says, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to dedicate my life in a matter just to being mindful, as mindful as I can, to be attentive, to be aware, to be compassionate. And they take the mindfulness as a lifetime path in a matter-of-fact way. And they're no longer completely preoccupied about highs and lows. They're just going to continue in a matter-of-fact way. And one of the nice things about being a teacher on retreats is to meet people over a many-year period who keep going back on retreats and see how much they change over the years and how the retreat experiences change. And then to notice at some point that they're happy. And they're really happy. And they're happy to be in retreat. They're happy not to be in the retreat. And they're dedicated themselves to a life of being on the path. And this quote by Suzuki Roshi: "Before Buddha attained enlightenment, he made all possible efforts for us. And at last he attained a thorough understanding of the various ways. You may think Buddha attained some stage where he was free from karmic life, but it is not so. Many stories were told by Buddha about his experiences after he attained enlightenment. He was not at all different from us. When his country was at war with a powerful neighbor, he told his disciples of his own karma and how he suffered when he saw that his country was going to be conquered by the neighboring king. If he had been someone who had attained an enlightenment in which there was no karma, there would have been no reason for him to suffer so. And even after he attained enlightenment, he continued the same effort he was making. After his enlightenment, he continued the same effort he was making. But his view of life was not shaky. His view of life was stable, and he watched everyone's life, including his own. He watched himself, and he watched others with the same eyes that he watched stones or plants or anything else. He had a very scientific understanding. That was his way of life after he attained enlightenment. When we have the traditional spirit to follow the truth as it goes and practice our way without any egoistic idea, then we will attain enlightenment in its true sense. And when we understand this point, we will make our best effort in each moment. This is true understanding of Buddhism. So our understanding of Buddhism is not just an intellectual understanding. Our understanding is at the same time is its own expression, is the practice itself. Constantly, we practice zazen, or mindfulness or meditation, with strong confidence in our true nature, breaking the chain of karmic activity and finding our place in the world of actual practice." So according to Suzuki Roshi, the practice that made the Buddha a Buddha is the same practice he continues after he's a Buddha. So there's no end to mindfulness practice. It isn't like you do this, you get to an end, then you can rest. You do it, and it's something we do with our whole life. It is our life, and it's a beautiful thing to do. So I talked again too long, but I managed to stop before 9 o'clock. So thank you, and I hope that some of you will be inspired to go on retreat.